Welcome, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Thanks for coming out tonight. My name is Tim Nepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake and also direct the Comparison Project, which is an experimental effort in a philosophy of religion that is historically grounded and religiously diverse. We want to philosophize about religion, raising questions of meaning, truth, and value, but we want to do so in a manner that is responsible both to the historical and cultural facts of religion and to the diversity of religious expressions in the world. And that's not all we want to do. More basically, the Comparison Project seeks simply to educate about religious diversity between and within the religions of the world and to provide a site for interfaith dialogue. And even that is not all that we want to do. I'm pleased to announce that we were recently awarded a grant that will help enable the creation of digital stories by and about the religions of Des Moines, and that in conjunction with this project, we will also be creating something in the way of a guide to religious diversity in Des Moines, which there's a considerable amount of. Both of those projects will begin this fall. All of this, of course, requires considerable time and resources. Apropos of that, let me take the time here to thank my research assistant for this semester, Todd Brown, who's conveniently disappeared right now, as well as the Comparison Project's 6 financial supporters, the Drake University Center for the Humanities, Humanities Iowa, the Medbury Fund, the Principal Financial Group's Center for Global Citizenship, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, and Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Deming Foundation. And although you probably already know this, I'm obliged to tell you that the opinions expressed in today's program do not necessarily reflect those of these supporters. Finally, I want to offer an apology to a resource that I overlooked, Drake's Coalition of Black Students. In the short 4 months that I've been directing the Comparison Project, time and time again I've learned not only the importance of reaching out to neighboring constituencies and sympathetic support, but also that no matter how much time I invest in this, I'm always leaving someone out. But in the case of a lecture on slavery, failing to ask for support from the Coalition of Black Students was spotless and irresponsible. I apologize again to them, and I'm glad that they chose to publicize our event nevertheless. 3 quick bits of housekeeping before we get started. Humanities Iowa, one of our funders, requires us to take attendance. You can sign up for this, and if you want to be added to their emailing list or our emailing list, you can indicate such. Yes. Thank you. Second, we have brochures outside in the back, hopefully you saw, and there are also evaluation forms. Humanities Iowa also asked us to seek for evaluations of our programs. So if you have a little time afterwards, I appreciate it if you would fill out an evaluation. Finally, know that you can find us on the web, Facebook, Twitter, whatever in the world that is, and all that other stuff. Okay. Our speaker tonight, Dr. Hector Avalos, is Professor of Religious Studies at Iowa State University, where he was named Professor of the Year in 1996, and a 2003-2004 Master Teacher. Born in Sonora, Mexico, Dr. Avalos received his BA in Anthropology from the University of Arizona, a Master's of Theological Studies from Harvard Divinity School in 1985, and a PhD in Biblical and Near Eastern Studies from Harvard in 1991. He is the author or editor of 9 books, including Fighting Words, The Origins of Religious Violence, and The End of Biblical Studies. As you may or may not, the theme for the programming of the Comparison Project this year is religious responses to suffering. Dr. Avalos' talk tonight offers a unique twist on this topic. For tonight, we will not be hearing about some religious response to suffering as much as we will be hearing about the failure of a religion to respond to suffering. Although a number of prominent writers have claimed that Christian and biblical ethics were ultimately responsible for the abolition of slavery in Africa and the New World, Dr. Avalos will, in contrast, argue that biblical arguments against slavery began to be abandoned by abolitionists themselves because the pro-slavery side actually had an advantage in biblical support for slavery. When Dr. Avalos agreed to participate in the program this year, I was thrilled. When Dr. Avalos agreed to participate in our program, I also knew that this would be the perfect opportunity to try out a different format for our lectures, one in which the lecture itself was followed by a response. Why? Because our own Department of Philosophy and Religion boasts a scholar of critical race studies, Jennifer Harvey. And here I scribble something in pencil that I can't read. Oh, yes, who is on sabbatical and therefore has all the time in the world to write and deliver a response. Dr. Harvey is Associate Professor of Religion at Drake in Des Moines, Iowa. She received her PhD in Christian Social Ethics from Union Theological Seminary. She is the author of Whiteness and Morality, Pursuing Racial Justice Through Reparations and Sovereignty, and a co-editor of Disrupting White Supremacy, White People on What We Need to Do. Her recent publications include work on contemporary reparation movements in Protestant traditions, queer articulations of Christian traditions, and Native colonial dialogues on issues of environmental justice. She is also an ordained minister in the American Baptist Churches, and she will be delivering a short response to Dr. Avalos' lecture at the conclusion thereof. But join me right now, please, in welcoming Dr. Avalos to Drake.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Kim. I have visited Drake before, but I've never spoken here. And I had the pleasure today of meeting some of Dr. Knepper's students, and what a wonderful group of students, wonderful conversation, and I hope we can continue that even after this lecture. Now, my topic is Who Ended Slavery? Secularization in Context, and just a shameless plug to begin, get out of the way, it is based on my book that was published in 2011, Slavery, Abolitionism, and the Ethics of Biblical Scholarship. And it explores a very genuine historical puzzle. The puzzle is that slavery was abolished in Western civilization between about 1791, that's the time of the Haitian Revolution, and 1900. It had existed for thousands of years in both Christian and non-Christian cultures. So why did abolition succeed at that time? So yes, from at least 3100 BCE, when we have our first written records, we see that slavery is part of human existence, if not before. But somehow in that period, that very small window between about 1791 and 1900, abolished in Western civilization. Now, this is important because the claim of Rodney Stark, a very well-known sociologist of religion and the author of For the Glory of God, among other works, states the following. Slavery did not die of its own inefficiency, and emancipation was not a capitalist ploy. Moral fervor is the fundamental topic of this entire book. The potent capacity of monotheism, and especially Christianity, to activate extraordinary episodes that have shaped Western civilization. So here is this claim that it was Christianity, biblical ethics, that was responsible for the abolitionism. So one thing about Dr. Stark, although he's respected in the sociology of American religion, he's not really an expert in biblical and Near Eastern studies, and I'll show how that has impacted his conclusions. We can find the idea that it was Christianity that abolished or helped to abolish slavery in the work of Orlando Patterson, one of the foremost historians of slavery. And in a book called Slavery in Text and Interpretation, he says, the cornerstone of my argument is that Christianity explains the nature, pervasiveness, and continuity of freedom in the West. And we have other popular versions of the idea. Dinesh D'Souza, for example, in What's So Great About Christianity, credits Christianity with the abolition of slavery, but his work often depends on Rodney Stark. D'Souza also does not consult the ancient primary sources himself. So how is this myth sustained that Christianity and biblical ethics abolished or was a major factor in the abolition of slavery? Well, I contend that there are at least four reasons. A, first of all, is the diminishing of accomplishments of non-biblical cultures. To say that biblical culture somehow had a feature in it that these other non-biblical cultures lack, and that eventually led to abolitionism. B, explaining away slavery in the Bible. So often we hear it wasn't really slavery, but indentured servitude or some other form of employment that's less than slavery. C, this myth is sustained by historical errors, and I'll point out some of them. And D, the use of incomplete or outdated historical data. So let me illustrate now each of those with examples. Here is one from For the Glory of God, which diminishes Egyptian culture. On page 326, Rodney Stark says, "The many gods of Egypt were not thought to concern themselves with how humans treated one another. Christianity was. Egyptians were not." The fact is that if he had read any Egyptian literature at all, he would know that there's such a collection of texts as the Book of the Dead. And in the Book of the Dead, you find a scene about, it's a judgment scene where a human being comes to the end of his life and has to account for his deeds on earth. And the text says, "I have acted rightly in Egypt. I have done what people speak of, what the gods are pleased with. I have given bread to the hungry, water to the thirsty, clothes to the naked." So how can Stark say that Egyptian religion did not have any concerns with how human beings treat each other? It's incorrect. In fact, it is the judgment scene in Matthew 25:42 that's probably an adaptation of something like the Book of the Dead. For in it, we also have a judgment scene at the end of time. And Jesus says to the one being judged, "For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me, naked and you did not clothe me, sick and in prison and you did not visit me." Very similar to hungry, thirsty, naked in the Book of the Dead. Rodney Stark said there was no sympathy in non-Hebrew cultures for people like slaves. He says, "There is no record that any philosopher in Sumer, Babylon, or Assyria ever protested against slavery, nor is there any expression of the mildest sympathy for the victims of this system." Here, this continues a very religious-centric idea that ancient Near Eastern cultures were not as advanced as biblical cultures. Somehow, biblical cultures had better features. But this is also not true. Because if you look at Hittite literature, the Hittites were a civilization from Turkey, flourished around 1415 to the 1200s or so. There is a prayer. And in this prayer, it is said, "If anything becomes too burdensome for a slave, he makes a plea to his master. His master hears him and pities him. Whatever is too burdensome for him, the slave, he, the master, sets right for him again." This shows that there was pity for slaves, unlike what Rodney Stark has alleged. And of course, we also find examples of exaggerating biblical ethics as if they were the only ones who ever thought of this. For example, often cited is Acts 17:26. "And he made from one every nation of men to live on all the face of the earth, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him. Yet he is not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and have our beings, as even some of your poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." So the idea here is that because Christianity believed that one creator had made everyone. Everyone was therefore brothers and sisters. That led to this feeling of abolition. But the very fact is, the very author of Acts tells us that the poets of Greece and Rome also had the idea, as even some of your poets have said. And indeed, in Epictetus, who flourished around 55 to 135, we find a similar sentiment. Kinsmen, brethren by nature, the offspring of Zeus. So they also had the idea that everyone was created by the same God. The fact is that the Bible consistently supports slavery from Genesis to Revelation. For example, in Leviticus 25, 44, it is said, as for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are around about you, and they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. This is the classic definition of slavery, treating human beings as possessions, as property for forced labor. So we do find it in the Bible. And it is as cruel as anything you'll ever see in any other Near Eastern culture. In Exodus 21, 20, for example, when a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be punished. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be punished, for the slave is his money. You can do whatever you want with your slave, because he is your property. And that does not change much in the New Testament either. The idea that somehow Christianity brought a more gentle religion is not true. In 1 Peter 2:18, it is said, you who are slaves must accept the authority of your masters with all respect. Do what they tell you, not only if they are kind and reasonable, but even if they are cruel. In fact, the New Testament made it worse for slaves. You see, under the Old Testament, there were term limits, at least for Hebrew slaves. They could only serve 6 years. The New Testament has no term limits for slaves. In the Old Testament, you were prohibited from enslaving fellow Hebrews. The New Testament does not prohibit you from enslaving fellow Christians. So it expanded the orbit of the pool of slaves that you could have. Now you could have many more types of slaves than were allowed in the Old Testament. So it is Ramsey McMullen, a Yale historian, who tells us, as to slaves, the disadvantages which they had suffered for centuries are well known. But nothing indicates that they were made easier by Christians' masters or their congregations. So many historians are aware Christianity did not make anything better for slavery, made it worse. But in terms of numbers, slavery grew with Christianity. As Christianity spread, so did slavery. That's how it came to Africa. That's how it spread to the New World, with the spread of Christianity. So in the Roman Empire, you have maybe 16 to 20% of the population were slaves. In Cuba, however, in 1500s, up to 90% of the population were slaves. In terms of absolute numbers, in the Roman Empire, you may have 2 to 10 million slaves, but in the transatlantic slave trade, you had 12 million slaves. So as Christianity spread, slavery spread. It did not reverse it at all. And when asked, why didn't Christianity lead on abolitionism? We are given a number of reasons. One is that of Ben Witherington, a very well-known evangelical scholar. And he says in his letters to Philemon, that would have required revolution, which in turn would have been a violation of the teaching of Jesus regarding nonviolence. So that's why Jesus didn't speak up against slavery. Paul, all of those did not speak up because that would have been too revolutionary. Richard Horsley of UMass Boston has a similar reason. Finally, over against apologists for Christianity, working from liberal individualistic perspectives and assumptions, it must be recognized that taking a stand in favor of abolishing slavery in Greek and Roman antiquity would not have occurred to anyone. Slavery was part and parcel of the whole political, economic, religious structure. The only way even of imagining a society without slavery would have been to imagine a different society. However, Horsley is wrong. He's wrong because, first of all, Christians were never required to have slaves. If they didn't want to have slaves, no one said you had to have them. So they could have said, our own members, our own Christians, shouldn't have slaves. It wouldn't really revolutionize much. And contrary to what Horsley claims, abolition did occur as an idea to some before Christianity. Philo, the Jewish author, tells us that among the Essenes, a Jewish sect, not a single slave is to be found among them, but all are free, exchanging services with each other, and they denounce the owners of slaves. So why does Horsley say it wouldn't have occurred as an idea? The fact is, a few places like Locris and Phocis in ancient Greece prohibited slavery. So it's not true that it did not occur as an idea. In fact, it is odd that the New Testament actually denounces so many types of evildoers. So in 1 Corinthians 6, 8, and 9, it is said, do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor sexual perverts, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor robbers will inherit the kingdom of God. Never, it said, slave owners will not inherit the kingdom of God. Why is that? In fact, Jesus had no trouble upsetting society otherwise. So in Matthew 10:34, it is said, do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have come not to bring peace on earth, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. If this is not disruptive to social structures, what is? So why wasn't slavery also among those social structures that he was willing to disrupt? In fact, Christian apologists want to have it both ways. On the one hand, Horsley tells us that it would have been too revolutionary to get rid of slavery. But on the other hand, he tells us that Paul had been commissioned to organize communities as beachheads of the alternative society that would come fully into the existence at the parousia of Christ. So on the one hand, he wants to see the Bible and the New Testament as revolutionary. And on the other hand, when it comes to slavery, it couldn't be too revolutionary. And, of course, there are historical errors, just simple ones, that I have found as I researched why slavery was so whitewashed in Christianity. Stark says, regarding St. Bathilde, as early as the 7th century, St. Bathilde, the wife of King Clovis II in what is now France, became famous for her campaign to stop slave trading and free all slaves. And this is a case where he didn't really read the sources or the original primary sources, because that's not really what the primary sources say. What it says is that she prohibited the existence of captive Christian slaves or men, not all types of slaves, which then is nothing new because we find that in Plato, where you can't enslave fellow Greeks. Leviticus says you can't enslave fellow Hebrews. The field is saying you can't enslave fellow Christians. Nothing new there. The in-group is not to be enslaved. It's the out-group. And some scholars clearly don't read very wisely when they write about slavery. Dinesh D'Souza would be one who simply quotes secondary sources and just repeats what they say, doesn't seem to look up anything. But here's Joe Panzer, a priest and U.S. Army chaplain, who wrote a very popular book, The Popes and Slavery. And he seemingly presents evidence that the popes were consistently against slavery. He cites bulls such as Sicut Judum and Sublimus Deus as evidence. He claims that many Catholics simply disobeyed papal teaching about slavery. That's why there was slavery. Just Catholics, like with contraception, didn't follow papal teaching. The fact is, Panzer has to redefine slavery to make his point. And he says on page 5, when speaking of the servitus, the normal Latin word for slavery, when speaking of the servitus which rested on one of the so-called just titles, we translate it as servitude. When speaking of that form of servitus which did not rest on just title, we translate the Latin as slavery. Well, what he's doing here is hiding it. What he's saying is, when enslavement is justified, that's called just title slavery, and that's okay. It's when it's not gotten through a just title. Just title meaning if you capture someone in war, or if they're fighting against you as an enemy of the church, then you can enslave them. But outside of that, that's not just title. So yes, the Pope spoke against unjust title slavery, but not against just title slavery. See, unless you read that, you're not going to get what he's saying. So he's just translating the same term in two different ways to make the point. So yes, just title slaves could be captives of wars, including those declared enemies, simply because they were not Christians. Other times, Panzer has misleading and selective readings of papal documents in his book. William Wilberforce often is cited as an abolitionist hero. And with some justification, he did lead the fight against slavery in British Parliament. He led efforts that resulted in the Slave Trade Act of 1807. And Stark hails him as an example of the triumph of Christian ethics. But again, you have Christopher Catherwood saying, Wilberforce is a classic example of evangelical activism in the best sense of seeing the duty to love your neighbor as yourself as something necessary to do alongside preaching conversion to those who do not know the message of salvation on the cross. So yeah, he's usually seen as an abolitionist hero. However, newer biographies take a different look at Wilberforce. For example, Stephen Tompkins argues that Wilberforce was complicit in slavery. This has even been accepted by Christianity Today, an evangelical publication, that Wilberforce was complicit in slavery now. Why? Because Wilberforce supported apprenticeships in Sierra Leone. And he had one of his military adjutants fired, basically, because he complained that these apprenticeships were too much like slavery. So on the one hand, he's against slavery over in England. Over here, he's setting up another system that's very much like slavery. So if we're going to explain why is it that slavery was abolished between 1791 and 1900, then how do we do it? It can't be the Bible. The Bible had been there for, 1800 years, and it hadn't done anything until then. Christianity had been there that long, had not done anything till then. So the key is explaining what was different between 1791 and 1900. And the differences are many, but I can pick at least three that were important. First, globalization of war and economies. Second, larger imbalances between slave populations and ruling populations. And third, the decline of biblical authority. As far as demographic imbalances were concerned, take a look at Haiti in 1791. There were 450,000 slaves, nearly 500,000 compared to 40,000 white slave masters and the slave society in general. You never really had that kind of imbalance before. And it's no surprise that Haiti was the first to abolish slavery in 1791. And it wasn't done through Christianity. It was done basically by appealing to African deities, not Christian. The Christians were the slave owners. So indeed, it's 1791 when Haiti overthrew slavery, that we should count as kind of the beginning of abolition, even though the historiography often begins with Britain. So Michael Laguerre of UC Berkeley says, the singularity of the Haitian Revolution stays in part in the religious ardor of the slaves, inflamed by the leaders who in turn were inspired by voodoo, loas. Voodoo simply just an African tradition transplanted to the Caribbean. To exterminate the colonists of Haiti, revolutionary leaders successfully used voodoo to make Haiti the first black republic in the New World. But you usually don't hear of African religions as liberatory at all. And third, I can cite the decline of biblical authority as a main factor. Biblical criticism arose with the Enlightenment in the 18th century. That's what was different between 1791 and 1900. Abolitionists moved away from using the Bible. Henning Groth Reventlow, a historian of biblical authority, says, the Bible lost its significance for philosophical thought and for the theoretical constitutional foundations of political ideas and ethical rationalism. The reasons for losing this authority were many again, but some include the rise of science, the rise of scientific criticism of the Bible. Archaeology failed to find evidence for many important events and figures, and pro-slavery advocates, more importantly, had an advantage when using the Bible. This is not an atheist saying it. This is the New Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, published by Abingdon, Methodist Press. And the article says, most embarrassing for today's readers of the Bible, the pro-slavery clergymen were holding the more defensible position from the perspective of historical criticism. The passages in the Bible about slavery signal the acceptance of an ancient model of civilization for which patriarchy and subjugation were not merely desirable, but essential. And Mark Knoll, who is an evangelical, in comparing the southern and northern strategies of biblical interpretation, says the North lost the exegetical war. They did not have the better arguments for abolitionism. Wilberforce knew it because there is a letter, still unpublished, that where he says concerning arguments in Parliament, there certainly cannot be a doubt as to the principle of the Holy Scriptures, especially of the New Testament, on the subject of the slave trade, or even that of slavery, though on the latter point, explanations would be required. But I believe it was better not to enter into any such discussion in the House of Commons for many reasons. The reasons were that other pro-slavery advocates were just as effective in using the Bible. And if you want the embodiment of the shift from biblically based ethics concerning slavery to secular humanist one, you can do no better than Frederick Douglass, who was born a slave in Maryland, taught himself to read, escaped to freedom. And in the early years, he thought the Bible was important. But in later years, he became a secular humanist. His master, when he converted to a form of evangelical Christianity, became worse, according to him. According to Douglass, prior to his conversion, he relied on his own depravity to shield and sustain him in his savage barbarity. But after his conversion, he found religious sanction and support for his slaveholding cruelty. And one of the things that Master quoted was Luke 12:47. He that knoweth his master's will and doeth it not shall be beaten with many stripes. In My Bondage and My Freedom, Douglass contemplated the possibility that the Bible did not have the type of ethics that would come from God. Should doctors of divinity ever convince me that the Bible sanctions American slavery, that Christ and his apostles justify returning men to bondage, then I will give the Bible to the flames and no more worship God in the name of Christ. And when we talked about Haiti, he also knew that British and American historiography was privileging British abolitionism and not giving Haiti its due. But Douglas says, until Haiti struck for freedom, the conscience of the Christian world slept profoundly over slavery. Until she spoke, no Christian nation had given the world an organized effort to abolish slavery. And evidence for Douglas's shift to secular humanism now comes from letters that were rediscovered in the 80s and 90s. And they pertain to correspondence with Ottilie Ossing, a German fan of Douglas, who eventually became his mistress. Later, she committed suicide in Paris. It's a very fascinating story that's told in this book by Maria Diedrich, Love Across Color Lines. So these letters are published in her book. And in one of them, she refers to his atheism. You should know Ossing was an openly atheist abolitionist. She corresponded with Ludwig Feuerbach, the famous German atheist. And Ossing and Douglas read Feuerbach's The Essence of Christianity together. So in one letter, she writes to Feuerbach and says, "For the satisfaction of seeing a superior man won over for atheism, I feel obliged to you." Most people don't know Douglas as a secular humanist or an atheist. Douglas kept a bust of Ludwig Feuerbach in his study. He kept a bust of D.F. Strauss, who doubted the divinity of Jesus, in his study. He opposed giving Bibles to slaves in a famous debate with the Reverend Henry Highland Garnet in 1849. And yes, it was the rise of science that affected his view. In 1883, he said, "Men are compelled to admit that the Genesis by Moses is less trustworthy as to the time of creating the heavens and the earth than are the rocks and the stars, geology and astronomy." He said, "It seems to me that the true philosophy of reform is not found in the clouds or in the stars, or anywhere else outside of humanity itself. So far as the laws of the universe have been discovered and understood, they seem to teach that the mission of man's improvement and perfection has been wholly committed to man himself. If that's not a secular humanist, I don't know what is. So is he to be his own savior or his own destroyer? He has neither angels to help him nor devils to hinder him." This could have been said by any secular humanist today. And when he compared how evangelicals fared to skeptics like Ingersoll, he said the following: "Infidel though Mr. Ingersoll may be called, he never turned his back upon his colored brothers, as did the evangelical Christians of this city on the occasion of the late visit of Mr. Moody." Moody is very famous, of course, among evangelical Christians. There's a Moody Institute that someone here went to, right? A faculty member. Other very famous abolitionists were also skeptics: Charles Darwin and Thomas Paine. And of course, Douglas already knew by 1885 that Christians were revising the history to distance themselves from slavery. He said, "Now that slavery is no more," of course, we got rid of it in the Civil War in the 1860s. "Now that slavery is no more, and the multitude are claiming the credit of its abolition, though but a score of years have passed since the same multitude were claiming an exactly opposite credit. It is difficult to realize that an abolitionist was ever an object of popular scorn and reproach in this country." The truth is that all the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are part of a slave master model of society. They were born within a slave master model. That is why today, even in worship, even generally, Christians call themselves servants of God. They call Jesus their Lord, God their Lord. And worship is patterned on slavery practices: bowing, kneeling. Those are all slavery practices. And indeed, these Abrahamic religions were really born between about 700 BCE and 700 CE. And what was the predominant model of society then? The slave master model. So they just simply transplanted that into the religion. So the Bible deserves very little credit because Christianity itself is patterned on slavery. The Bible allowed and encouraged the growth of slavery on an unprecedented and massive and global scale. A shift away from using the Bible, even by abolitionists, meant that humanitarian and economic arguments became more significant as time went on. So you have activist scholars like Thomas Clarkson, who, though a Christian, brought stunning visual evidence of slavery to British masses who had no firsthand knowledge of the atrocities of slavery. And if you look at why did segregation begin to falter in the South, well, because of the rise of television and media that allowed people in the North to see what was going on down there. And so even Martin Luther King had to reinterpret the Bible to make it say something it did not say in its original context. Confronting suffering directly can do a lot more good than just scriptural authority. In conclusion, if slavery is regarded as inexcusably wrong, then the Bible fails this ethical test miserably. The Bible is part of a world whose ethics and values are best left in the past. And the modern world must completely unshackle itself from using the Bible as any sort of ethical or social authority. Let's go to a post-scriptural society where our ethics are not based on what a text says from the ancient world at all. So if you want a more detailed argument, I refer you again to Slavery, Abolitionism, and the Ethics of Biblical Scholarship. So I'll stop there, and I'll let Professor Harvey give her response.
Good moment. Thank you very much. But don't leave the room. Is this a good volume in the back? Okay. Thank you so much. To the Comparison Project for inviting me, and to Dr. Avalos for his work. There is a lot to engage here, and I suspect we're going to have a very robust discussion. And so I want to frame my response in two basic parts. And the first part's really easy. It goes like this. I agree. The second part begins with, but. I come to this project already quite sympathetic with most of Dr. Avalos' claims. But even if I didn't, his extensive evidence and rigorous analysis makes most of his claims difficult to refute, even if I were so inclined. I've actually read the more detailed argument. So by way of I agree, I want to really emphasize three of what I think are his most important claims. First, and now I'm quoting from his book, biblical and Christian ethics were not a major factor in explaining the triumph of abolitionism between 1775 and 1863, or in any other period, end quote. While most of this project is concerned with Bible and biblical ethics, this is a claim about history and how we understand it. It's a significant claim, and it's also, I believe, highly defensible. At least it's defensible if we assume Bible and biblical ethics to be what Dr. Avalos seems to assume that they are, and that's going to come in part of my but part. So in his book, Dr. Avalos makes this case by analyzing extensively the extent to which abolitionist literature actually engaged Bible, namely not at all. The pro-slavery apologists did have the advantage. He also assesses other conditions that more adequately explain the success of abolition. But the real significance of this claim, I think, is that by successfully making it, Dr. Avalos exposes one deployment of what he calls religionist assumptions posing as objective descriptive scholarship. If historical evidence overwhelmingly suggests that, in fact, Bible was not a major factor in ending slavery, and I absolutely agree with him here, Avalos is spot on to suggest that this inaccuracy is more than just bad scholarship. Instead, a deeper and much more dangerous kind of mystification is at work. There's an ideology here that is covering up and distorting our ability to see and wrestle with the actual. In the face of such exposure, the questions to my mind become why the existence of such a positivist, self-evident, triumphalist role for Bible in the face of such overwhelming evidence to the contrary? What are the motives there? Whose interests are served by that? Dr. Avalos certainly has his own responses to these questions. Mine include a claim that this religionist approach is of a seamless piece with a positivist, exceptionalist, triumphalist, we might even say religionist, I really like that concept, reading of the U.S. American Project as a whole. This is a reading we are all quite familiar with. It goes something like this. At its essence, this nation is a nation of freedom. We could substitute Bible there, right, for nation. At its essence, we are on a divinely endowed trajectory of relentless and inevitable justice and equality. Slavery and genocide were more like moral bumps on the road, as opposed to what they really were, which was thoroughly constitutive of our nationhood. We can see glimpses of the power and the agenda of this reading when we recognize how inviolable mythological images of Thanksgiving are. Even though we know U.S. Native history is a history of genocide. Try saying that at your Thanksgiving dinner table and see what happens. Or when we paint Thomas Jefferson as a father of liberty, a father who can also somehow be credited with hating slavery even though he never freed the men or women that he enslaved. I have argued in other work that the very construct American is both produced through discourse and structures, material structures, that in a tangled together way are imperialist, white, and Christian, small c. So I'm not surprised at all that this religionist reading that Dr. Avalos exposes here is taking place in relationship to one of the United States' original sins, slavery. This recuperation of Bible as the cause of abolition is part of a larger ideological cloak that recuperates the United States as a land of freedom. Same thing. Secondly, again, quoting from Dr. Avalos' book, if there is a representative position in the Bible, it is one that accepts, endorses, or promotes slavery as a justified part of the human condition. Now, I want to bracket the if part of that sentence for later, and at this point, just note that I'm very persuaded of this claim as well. I find no compelling argument that in its original contexts or in its subsequent interpretive history, the Bible objects to slavery. In addition, God does sanction genocide. Biblical writers do celebrate smashing enemy babies on rocks. Jesus does compare a Syrophoenician woman to a dog. And I have long been suspicious when Christians claim that the Bible is anti-slavery, that Jesus was a feminist, or that LGBT communities would be wise to throw our lot in with Paul. Here again, the implications of Avalos successfully arguing his claim are as important as the claim itself. His relentless reading of the pro-slavery assumptions of the Bible diagnoses an illness that festers not only in Christian contexts, confessional Christian contexts, but as it turns out, in secular scholarly engagements of Bible as well. For Christians, the diagnosis shows into sharp relief the long-standing but almost unequivocally unacknowledged need for a deep and sustained wrestling with their actual relationship to Bible. Not what Christians say they do with Bible, but what they actually do with it. Now, I realize it's not probably Dr. Avalos' greatest aspiration to enable better theology, but I think that his work can do so. Christian theology contends mightily with this question. Where do we begin in making theological claims? What sources can be used, and on what grounds do you justify their use? And something that always haunts this query, how far can intellectual justification actually get you in saying something about God? And when do you simply have to make an a priori commitment to something as a starting point and just say, well, I'm going to start here? Now, different traditions debate how to use or weight sources like reason, experience, nature, etc. But on the whole, in the Christian tradition, Bible has usually been the answer as the a priori starting point. Whether or not it gets acknowledged is a different question. But Avalos' analysis makes so clear not only how vexed this is as a starting point, namely, do you really want to lodge your claims, your theological claims, in a pro-slavery document, but also makes clear the reality that it's always been interpretive work rather than Bible itself that is the actual starting point. Namely, if theology can recuperate such a pro-slavery text, let's get very honest about the reality that something else other than Bible is what's going on. To my mind, coming to terms with the implications of these recognitions might enable more robust, intellectually consistent, and spiritually sound faith practices. Lastly, in terms of the I agree, if slavery is regarded as inexcusably wrong, then biblical ethics stands or falls on its attitudes towards slavery. As such, this book is a critique of the broader idea that the Bible should be the basis of modern ethics. This statement may sound clear and logical, but for those of you unfamiliar with the field of Christian ethics, this is, in fact, the throwing down of the gauntlet. Despite its endless problems, what the Bible says continues to be the bread and butter of most scholarly work in Christian ethics, and that is true from the evangelicals to the progressives. And it's here that I find myself most wanting to respond with a loud, I agree. I have a colleague in Christian ethics who recently wrote a piece for Huffington Post, actually, called, prepare yourself, Jesus Hates Homosexuality, So What? In it, she warns, and she's a Christian ethicist, that it's simply unwise for justice-seeking Christians to invoke biblical authority. She also says it's dishonest for anybody to do so. And she closes with this question. When was the last time you turned to the Bible to see what it said about something, and it actually made you change your mind about that thing, about anything? Her larger point is Christians simply need to give better reasons for any number of their views. Given what's in it, given how people use it, the burden of proof for basing modern ethics on the Bible is with those who would claim to do so. Avalos convincingly demonstrates why this burden of proof cannot be met, and more importantly to my mind, he indicts a field for not even acknowledging that the burden exists at all. I agree. But while I'm persuaded by most of his discrete claims, I begin to part ways with Avalos, I think, when it comes to his larger assumptions about the terms of the debate and the implications of his project for biblical engagement. I think. At least I have some questions. In an African Americans and the Bible Project, Vincent Wimbush has asked two provocative questions, and now I'm quoting him. What might be the implications and ramifications of construing the study of the Bible on bases other than European cultural presumptions and power, interests, and templates? Elsewhere he writes, quote, how might putting African Americans at the center of the study of the Bible affect the study of the Bible? I love this radical question. And I note here, Wimbush is not suggesting we should ask what the Bible actually says about black people. In fact, he would charge that that question has already been framed by European presumptions and power and interests. Instead, Wimbush argues that foregrounding the African American experience, quote, represents a radical challenge, represents a challenge to the still largely unacknowledged, interested, invested, racialized, culture and ethnic specific practice of biblical interpretation. On the one hand, I suspect that Dr. Avalos would agree with Wimbush's characterization of the practice of biblical interpretation. But what is less clear to me, however, is whether he leaves any room for living engagement with texts that don't assume or rely on these white European framings of the meaning of Bible and biblical engagement. So Wimbush, for example, argues for a conception of Bible not as a text, but as a phenomena, a profoundly human one, an unapologetically profoundly human one. Communities endow texts with sacred power and authority. Wimbush calls this scripturalizing, and he's drawing on others to make this claim. My question, about which I want to hear more, is whether this conception can be granted any legitimacy in the way that Avalos frames the biblical problem. I think I see this possibility foreclosed, for example, when in his book, Dr. Avalos dismisses interpretive strategies, and he gives evidence of three of them, representativism, trajectorialism, and reinterpretation. And in his reading, these three ways of interpreting Bible not only seem to exhaust the available possibilities for engagements with Bible, but they all depend on a kind of valorization of original meaning as relevant. So, for example, he says, when we reinterpret Bible, and I think when he mentioned Dr. King here and said, Dr. King had to say the Bible said something else, he reinterpreted it away from its original meaning. That's not legitimate because it's so far removed from original meaning that it's not really interpretation. This was one point of many in Dr. Avalos' work where I thought perhaps he was conceding the right to set the terms of discussion to the very traditions he so brilliantly critiques. My concern here has nothing to do with a desire to recuperate the Bible as having any pre-existent moral authority or any essentially liberative meaning. Nothing to do with that. It has to do with a possible erasure of profound human activity. So Wimbush wants to ask, for example, and wants to be able to ask, quote, not about the meaning of any text, but about the whole quest for meaning in a relationship to a sacred text. And he puts sacred in brackets, because sacred for Wimbush is a human activity, but it's still sacred. Wimbush sees this quest as a critical way to even read the history of African peoples in the so-called New World, because he sees in the experience of people of African descent engagements with these books through which survival and triumph are articulated. I'm not sure, as Dr. Avalos frames the enterprise, that Wimbush's project can have a serious reading, and that's something that concerns me. And so I would love to hear more about that. My second concern, then, or parting of ways, perhaps, is with what is with more of a kind of valorization of reason in this project that I find somewhat troubling. And here it may be that I'm naming something that emerges to the extent that his project relates to and it meaningfully relates to New Atheism and the way it thinks about the phenomena of religion. And I don't want to create a straw person, but my reading of that movement is sort of that religion is kind of cast as kind of uniquely irrational and singularly perhaps dangerous. In any case, I have several concerns about reason and the way it might be functioning in this analysis. First, I don't need to be an apologist for Christianity, which I most assuredly am not, or for religion generally, to insist that reason just does not capture the entirety of human experience and how we talk about it. It's not true in relation to any area of human existence, but it's certainly not enough, I think, in regard to the kind of complex world-shattering realities of the Middle Passage and the way African peoples responded to it. I don't know that reason can get us enough of a reading of those meanings there. For another thing, just as science, which is often valorized as better than religion, science has a history deeply implicated in white racial terror on this land base. Reason, too, has a history wrought with many, many terrors. And my point isn't that, religion's just because religion's bad, well, science and reason are bad, too, so don't throw rocks at religion. My point is we need to throw rocks all over the place. So I'm obviously not worried that Avalos doesn't see those histories for the devastations and horrors that they are, but rather if possibly the valorization of reason is wielded against the Bible in a way that then can't account for other complex forms of human activity that actually constitute Bible. So, for example, consider Nat Turner or Denmark Vesey or Gabriel, who called himself or was called the Black Samson. All of these men embodied a kind of mystical relationship with biblical text in a manner that stirred rebellion. In Wimbushian terms, these men get to be read as engaged in sacred activity. We get to name this activity as a site where the phenomena of Bible is being produced. That's Bible. Their rebellions are generating meaning as selves read and read themselves into and through a text. And as an ethicist, I would read explicitly moral and ethical dimensions and productions at this sacred site. I wouldn't call it biblical ethics, but I also couldn't just chuck the Bible piece out of the window either without distorting what's taking place there. So I'm not saying Turner or Vesey couldn't have rebelled if they hadn't had the Bible. I'm not saying that. Or that, oh, turns out the Bible was liberative after all. No. But what I'm asking is whether in Avalos' framing we can read them as something other than either maybe duped in a way or worse, perhaps some sort of irrational. And so I want to hear more about that. And it's here where I want to bring back the statement about if there is a representative position in the Bible, because I want to push on this point about Bible. I think the real questions in this important shaking of religionist claims about slavery get revealed as if there is a Bible at all, and if so, what is it? So what happens if we put Nat Turner at the center of how we think about what the Bible is? All the range of possibilities for what might be or what we might see change, I think, and I'm not sure the sort of valorization of reason is the only thing that can help us really get into and see the meanings there. So, in other words, I just, as a Christian ethicist who does not import biblical texts into my claim making, and who agrees with Dr. Avalos that Bible, at least in the sort of formal sense as a set of texts, is a deep problem as well as much of the interpretive history is a problem, I want to insist on both repudiating and also honoring the human phenomena of Bible. I'm not willing to let Turner and Vesey go. I'm also not willing to call them duped. And perhaps Dr. Avalos is also not either, but I want to know what I get to do with them. And does what I do with them get to bear meaningfully on the project of biblical engagement? So I want to just close by repeating how impressed I was with this book. Not only its exhaustive nature, but what I see to be in it, a profound intellectual honesty and courage. I also want to repeat that my critical questions come from having a real intellectual and, to be honest, a real emotional affinity with this work. There's a shaking of religionism and racialism and nationalism here that I think is a hugely important contribution to both biblical studies as well as to Christian ethics. And so my critical questions come from that place, not from the place where I suspect Dr. Avalos gets most of his pushback. I suspect he gets or will get a lot. And so what I just would love to hear more about in the questions I'm raising is how the interpretive communities, other than those that who's aside from Frederick Douglass, those big old white guys up there who just dominated the screen, how they too might really benefit from the profoundly important contributions that this text makes. Thank you so much for your work. Oh, goodness, yes.
What more could you want from Valentine's Day? Thought-provoking. Thank you very much. We're going to give Dr. Avalos an opportunity first to respond to Dr. Harvey, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Well, thank you, Dr. Harvey, for that critique, and I loved it. From the point you said, I agree. And then after that, I kind of lost track. the questions you've asked are some of the ones that I pondered myself a few times. They've been asked of me a couple of times. So let me take them in turn if I understand them. One of them is about my valorization of reason in critiquing religionism and slavery. And my answer is that I'm not sure that I can not valorize reason, because any critique of reason involves reason itself. So how is it that we can critique reason even without using reason? So any time that someone says, you know, you're valorizing empirical rationalism, but they're using empirical rationalist techniques to critique empirical rationalism, I say that is an instance of self-referential incoherence to me. You cannot critique reason without using reason, which itself valorizes reason again. And you cannot critique empiricism without pointing to facts or something, some sense datum, which valorizes empiricism again. So I don't think you can escape the use of reason. And any time that you use reason to critique reason, you are valorizing reason. And so that's my general response to that. Now, in terms of what that does to interpretive communities, I didn't specifically talk about those figures that you thought might be seen as dupes, I wouldn't see them as that. I would say that they have certain assumptions that I would not say can be validated once you scrutinize them more, but that would go for almost anything in the ancient world in terms of science. We no longer believe certain things about the nature of the universe, the nature, the age of the universe, how it was created, how these organisms were framed. All were critiqued in the same way as I do the Bible. We look at the evidence, how words were used. I know language is very difficult. Sometimes in the ancient world, we're talking with the students this morning. Well, how do you know what an author meant in the ancient world? Does authorship make sense? And, well, you understand ancient authors the same way you understand what I'm saying. You know, we look at the words that people use, usages and so forth, and that's how we come to certain beliefs about what the Bible meant. Now, with regard to whether the Bible even makes sense as an artifact, I would say no, it doesn't, because the Bible is itself an artificial construct, and I understand that. It's actually, I'm a little more radical. I say it's probably a scholarly construct. That is, it was scholars who selected the manuscripts and who make the text through textual criticism. It's really not a movement from below at all. It's actually a movement from above, where scholars impose what this biblical text is and then have people read it. As you probably know in history, for a long time, the church didn't want people to read the Bible unsupervised. And the canons of Oxford of 1408, very explicitly, we do not want people to read this document. So the whole idea of biblical literacy is actually quite new, that you should be literate with the Bible. And I say that's a project of Protestantism. That's a project that started with Protestantism. If you look at the history in England particularly, it went from don't read the Bible in the Oxford Constitutions to everyone has to read the Bible. Why? Because Protestants thought it would undermine Catholic doctrine. So to me, the whole enterprise of being biblically literate and using the Bible, it's itself just another religionist project, you know, part of a sectarian war, actually, to me. So in regards to Winbush and whether, you know, there's room for the use of what I might call reinterpretation or different types of interpretation, I would say I question the entire enterprise of using text as any sort of authority. That itself is new in human history. I'm an anthropologist by training, and you know, so I tend to look at humanity as a species in a very long, broad terms. And writing really was only invented really around 3100 BC. People lived thousands of years without any sacred authority and a text. You know, how were they doing it? They apparently were good enough to survive this long without text, good enough to reproduce. Where did the idea come from that text have to provide authority at all? Well, somewhere around 3100 BC in societies where the elite controlled the writing, you know, very few people were able to read or write in the ancient world. It was the province of the elite that it was the idea gathered steam that, yes, if it's in writing, therefore you should follow it. And we're still living with the consequences of that textualism. So I say, yes, I have argued, actually as a liberation theologian at one point, I put myself in the shoes of one. And I said, you know, if you want to be truly liberatory, you should work towards the liberation of text. The idea, the whole idea that text should provide some authority for modern living. To me, the core of ethics is empathy. And I come at it again from an anthropological viewpoint, from the idea that we have certain biological features as human beings that enable us to care for other human beings. Empathy can be found in apes. It can be found in other creatures. That's why you can see dogs taking care of a litter, why you can see apes give up their food for those that they perceive to be hungry. And experiments by Franz de Waal, whose work I really admire, is experiments on apes, he shows that all those features of morality and ethics you can find in a more, shall we say, primitive form among apes in our relatives. So I think that when you start to use text, you simply just complicate things. After all, if you love your children, would you love them less because a text says you shouldn't? I would say most of us wouldn't. You know, why are we using text at all to comport ourselves, to care for others? Why do we need a text? In fact, to me, it's actually unethical that we would say, well, I'm not going to care for such and such person unless a text tells me I should. Why should that be? Where did we ever get the logic to say that text should do that? Well, if you say that text should somehow guide us, you're still valorizing what was originally really an elite enterprise to control people. And I would suggest to you that if we concentrate on empathy for other human beings and act on the basis of what we see, the suffering we see, and our ability to diminish that suffering when we can, that's a much better system than guiding ourselves by the will of some being whose mind we will never be able to read or verify. That only complicates morality to me. It's also undemocratic because, at least with empirical rationalist morality, everyone has access to the same basic evidence. Everyone can see the same things I claim to see. When it comes to religionist morality, it becomes undemocratic because eventually only a few people will claim to see what everybody else, you know, is supposed to follow. So it is inherently undemocratic to me to say God only speaks to a few and then he wrote a text so that you have to follow it, even though you'll never know whether I actually spoke to God or not. To me, that's much more undemocratic. And so I would say, yes, I believe in reason. I believe in valorizing reason because I don't know how else to do anything but with reason.
Jen, do you want a chance to? Okay. Do you have any questions? I think that I'm going to come to you so that you can speak into this microphone. Julian?
I spoke with you earlier in my philosophy of religion course, and just by speaking to you then, I learned a lot. I think you raise a lot of interesting points. And going back to your concept of there's only certain individuals who can derive truth through religion, it reminds me of what Thomas Aquinas, you know, he had the eternal law, natural law, and then divine law. And natural law we acquired through our reason, and then divine law were those through divine revelation. And I think that concept in itself is flawed because, like you said, it promotes inequality because only certain people are able to acquire this knowledge. So my question, I didn't really think of a question. I just was complimenting you on that. what would you say, or here's a good question. Every time I have an argument with someone about religion, it always goes to the Big Bang. And, you know, it's like they're ace in the hole because we don't have an explanation for that occurrence. So they say, well, you can't answer it, so it must be God. So, I mean, how would you respond to someone who says that to you?
I usually respond in two ways. And the question was, since we can't explain the Big Bang, how would I explain the origin of everything without God or something like that? Well, first of all, the fact that science cannot explain something does not mean religion can. So it's just a fallacy to say if science can't explain how, for example, the Earth goes around the sun, but religion must have the answer. See, that's a fallacy to say that if one answer is not available, the other one must have the answer. So that's number one. Number two, there is no reason why something cannot come from something it was not. In fact, it's actually the common thing in the universe. take, for example, water. Water, you know, under normal atmospheric pressure, boils at about 100 degrees centigrade. It freezes at zero, and it can dissolve a number of things. Now, water is composed of, you know, two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom, which don't have those properties. So hydrogen does not boil at 100 degrees centigrade, nor does it freeze at zero, and neither does oxygen. Hydrogen does not have certain properties to dissolve things the way water does. So this thing we call water and waterness comes from something that was not water. See that? And just like water can come from non-water, life can come from non-life. It's not a mystery at all.
This is going to get ridiculous after a while.
Professor, can you hear me? Okay, good. I was in class with Julian as well, philosophy of religion. So my question that I have relates to history. So first off, I want to say that your biblical argument to me makes a lot of sense. I'm not going to challenge that because you know your stuff about the Bible, and I know I don't. But my problem I have with the argument is it's history. Now, it's obvious that we can't say Christianity was causative in the institution of slavery because it existed before Christianity, before writing probably. But to say that Christianity was participatory in slavery is also clear from like the Frederick Douglass example, where a slave master beat him even more after becoming an evangelical Christian. My concern, though, is to say that Christianity was pivotal in the continued existence of slavery. That if Christianity didn't exist, or if those lines of scripture didn't reference slavery, that slavery would have ended sooner. For me, to argue that Christianity was the linchpin of slavery throughout 2,000 years of Christianity and 2,000 years of slavery begins with an assumption about how history works I find very problematic, because it ignores a lot of other circumstances grounded in the material world that would predispose a society to slavery. So what's your reaction to that?
We can show that what's called Christianity was a crucial factor in the spread of slavery, both empirically and mathematically. Because as slavery grew, for example, as Christianity grew into Africa and into the New World, slavery grew. So they are correlated empirically. So how would you explain the growth of slavery in the New World? If before Christianity, there hardly was any slavery among most Native Americans. It's after Christianity came, there was slavery. So when you see a variable like that, you can say that was the cause. You know, when you see that at time X, something was the case, and it was not the case for 2,000 years or 1,500 years, and then Y came in, and now it was a change, then you can say that's causative. So just on the basis of just simple historical causational analysis, yes, you can say that when a variable changes, you know, everything in the New World after 1492, let's say, you must attribute some causational effort to that. Now, in terms of ideology, yes, all of the people that supported slavery did so on the basis of quoting the Bible and quoting specific passages and saying, you know, your Lord is Jesus now. You Native Americans, your Lord is Jesus now. It's not whoever you're worshiping. So ideologically, you can see that Christianity was causative of slavery than, for example, in the New World. So I think that if Christianity had not come to the New World, I doubt there would have been slavery on that kind of scale. In fact, we didn't see it. You know, like, we had had American Indians living here for thousands of years without that kind of slavery system, because mostly they were small bands and tribes. And so, yes, it was when Christianity was introduced that we see this massive kind of slavery. Yes. Yeah, they were, but they were not the majority of the Native Americans in the New World. I mean, they're basically Mesoamerica. You know, say 90% of Native Americans did not live like the Mayans or the Aztecs. And it was after Christianity came that almost 90% of Native Americans were enslaved or destroyed or forced to convert. Not before that. So, yeah, that's the variable.
Mm-hmm. Was very removed from what the Bible actually said, like the Crusades. So couldn't it have been that Christian community as a whole based on the Bible was the interpretation of biblical ethics in helping?
No, my thesis is that those abolitionists or communities who support abolition on the basis of the Bible were not really doing the best interpretive work in terms of what did the Bible mean in its original context, which they themselves would say is important to them. They're not saying a lot of them were reinterpreting. No, they actually think that Jesus did say those things, or that in Leviticus 19:18, where it says love your neighbor, it meant everybody. When we know it doesn't mean everybody, you know. So things like that they were wrong about in terms of, or reasonably we can say, they weren't interpreting it the way they thought it, what it meant, you know. Now, if you say, well, didn't communities use the Bible being abolitionist? Yeah, but the pro-slavery people also had a community, and they were using the Bible to fight against abolition. And it really took, in our country, a civil war to get that viewpoint out. You know, it wasn't, Christianity didn't say, oh, well, we're going to stop now because we realize slavery is bad. No, it took a civil war. It was force that really made the difference in ending this system. And the Haitian Revolution was force. You know, it wasn't really, you know, some rising Christian sympathy for slavery. Now, to a point, that is true. That is to say, when Thomas Clarkson and other very good activist scholars, and I believe in activist scholarship, made these drawings of what it was like to be in a slave ship, you know, and showed it to these British people who never had seen really, they didn't live in slavery, in a slave society. And in Britain, far removed from the Caribbean for the most part, when they start to see this and be confronted with it, you know, that empathy would come out. You know, just like the rise of television to me is a big factor in how segregation fell. You know, people up in the North were seeing what these dogs are doing to these people and said, we don't want to do that. And so that, you know, so empathy enters into that picture, but because of humanitarian concerns, really, more than anything else, you know, once you start seeing something you've never seen before. Right now, for example, most people don't know what drones are doing in Afghanistan. We don't see it. They don't want you to see it. You know, I bet you want, if you start to videotape and show videotape on the news of what children killed by bombs and dismembered are doing, America probably would rise against it. You know, but right now we are sort of distracted, and the system wants to keep you distracted with, you know, housewife shows and Downton Abbey, even, which I watch. you know, they don't want you to see this other stuff. They don't want you to see coffins coming back from Iraq, you know, because they know it would arouse empathy for these people. See, so when the system wants you not to have empathy, what they do is hide it. And with the rise of Facebook, and it's harder and harder to hide that suffering. You know, Facebook in Egypt and in Syria, you know, it's harder for those regimes to stay because so many people are now seeing through Twitter and through what they're doing. See, before they were able to control that information. So, yes, sir. Yes. Yes. The issue with that idea is that, well, those all those ideas about liberty and freedom were there for 2,000 years. The Greeks had a lot of the ideas from Jefferson and so forth. I can find in the Greek writers. So if they were already there in the Greek writers, why did it take that long? You know, what changed? Something had to change right around, you know, 1775, 1791. What was it? Because it wasn't just the rhetoric of liberty and freedom. That had been there already. In fact, I can find it in Mesopotamia. You know, something else was different there. And what I contend is there are many factors. It's not one. But certainly demographic imbalances were amazing at that time. And the going away from the Bible, you know, and saying, you know, these people are suffering, and we have to stop their suffering no matter what the Bible says. And Frederick Douglass came to that conclusion. I don't care what the Bible said. You know, we have to free these people. You know, even if Jesus said the opposite, I'll do it. You know, so empathy overruled textuality.
But and you know, and maybe you talked about this, but the Bible speaks in many voices, and the voices mean in different ways. And I agree with you that to take the text as a whole authoritatively doesn't do the text justice, and is downright dangerous because the authority is taken at a certain high level, you know, that being the voice of God or the will of God. But what about what the different voices in the Bible have to offer in terms of ways to think about God, ways to think, really, the problematical relationship between human beings and God. The master-slave model that you talked about is indeed problematical, but there's thinking that flows from that in terms of how we might think about God through the stories in the text itself. So I guess my question is, what about the possibility of listening to those different voices mean in different ways?
Thank you.
I have no problem with listening to voices in the Bible, but I would expand it to listen to Egyptian voices, listen to Mesopotamian voices as well. Why limit it to this group of texts? But secondly, I make a distinction between agreeing with voices in the Bible and using them as a basis of my morality. Those are two very different things to me. I can agree that, you know, some people in the Bible said good things, but whether they said it or not, that's not going to be why I do them. You know, the basis has to be different than something in a text, even if I agree with a text. Most certainly. Yeah, I think if it hadn't been for the Bible, we would have been farther, much farther along in women's rights and gay rights. Well, gay rights, I would have to do more research, really, on that. But I think we would. In fact, almost the entire basis of anti-gay rhetoric today is biblical. There's really no other reasons given, you know, why people shouldn't marry if they're gay. But the ones they come up with are very poor. You know? Well, they don't reproduce. Well, neither do infertile couples, and they get married. But almost inevitably, I mean, if you listen to Bob Vanderplas or someone of that ilk, they eventually go back to biblical authority. There are really no other reasons that I can think of that are voiced as often as that against gay marriage.
Seems to me that all left to the right, from progressives to evangelicals, whatever, that have always carried on a sort of kind of argument among themselves that excludes the rest of the population, mass of society who labor, they're building the pyramids or riding in slave ships across the Atlantic. So it seems to me that there's a kind of way in which we're talking among ourselves in ways that aren't impacted, ironically, and that we are still part of that tradition of hierarchical rule that disseminates its power in different ways through the intelligentsia, who belong maybe more to a kind of professional class now of experts and people who, you know, kind of guard the authority of the text from the masses of people who have the manuals rather than mentally.
Yes.
And so it seems to me then that what we're dealing with is the transition from chattel slavery to wage slavery. We still belong to a tradition of empire, of imperial civilization that was established 3,100
years ago. Yes. I agree with you.
And that we, in fact, are, it seems to me that we are, you know, more than anything, capitalism explains the disappearance of chattel slavery because it's been replaced by something that's more economic. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. In fact, I often think that there is a trend in New Testament biblical scholarship to see text as anti-imperialistic, you know, against empire. And I'm saying, no, you're just wanting to replace one empire with another. Your empire is called the kingdom of God, but it would be ruled by people who then would tell other people what to do. So, you know, so to see any anti-imperialism in the Bible is very difficult for me. You know, it's all imperialistic. You know, I see biblical scholarship as part of the empire, not someone fine. They're within the empire. You know, they're just trying to kind of fiddle with the edges, but they're still part of the empire. You know, we have an ecclesial academic complex in the U.S. Most biblical scholars are still affiliated with a denomination of some sort, or, you know, very few are like me that I don't have any religious affiliation. But so it's still part of an ecclesial academic complex, part of whose history was slavery.
Maybe we have time for a couple more questions.
Going back to the responses after the main presentation, regarding authorial intent and the development of the information age, you made it clear your point about empathy and the increase of it as we become more aware of human suffering throughout the world through information trading. And in recent years, we have developed both an increase in empathy, but also an increase in anti-empathy, where individuals go out to take advantage of the fact that empathy is so widely available for their own end. My question is, given this age where such an enormous audience is granted to any individual, and empathy is so widely available, how is it that authorial intent will evolve in the future based off of this new format?
I'm not sure that authorial intent will be the determining factor in the amount of empathy. I think that the human species, like in almost every behavior, has a spectrum. And there are people with no empathy and there are people with lots of it. You know, lots of empathy actually can make you stressed out, because you see the news every day and, you know, you care so much that you're going to be destroyed. So there's a feedback mechanism, too, that stops, you know, too much empathy will kill you. You know, too little empathy will kill everyone. And just like sexuality, too, you know, the spectrum is, you know, some people are on this side or that side of sexual spectrum. So the most we can ever do is join up with people that have the similar amount of empathy to enact whatever it is that we think should be enacted. You know, and it's a case in society, you never have to convince everyone. You just have to convince enough people to do what you think should be done.
I sure would like to hear more about two of your intriguing notions, Jen, if I heard them correctly. You haven't had a chance to field a single question. So a Bible-less Christianity? something along those lines. And then maybe a notion of a Bible beyond Bible or textuality beyond text.
Did I say that? Yeah, maybe.
No, as textuality is phenomenon
Bible
rather
phenomenon.
Than...
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think in your response, Dr. Avalos, I'm not sure that I heard kind of a response to that. And it was touched on a little bit in this gentleman's comment in the back that, you know, what I understand Wimbush's African Americans in the Bible Project to be is not so much even in his articulation, a valorization of, oh, African Americans have the only or the most unique or the paradigmatic relationship with Bible. But what Wimbush is trying to do is argue that in the context of the so-called New World, particularly the United States, that the entire framework for how we even think about what Bible is, I mean, we're using the word Bible as if it's self-evident what it is. And in fact, I agree that it's a construct. And Wimbush's point with which I'm quite taken is, if we center the transatlantic terror through which people of African peoples and people of African descent ultimately sort of survived, and you have to, in taking that history seriously, look at profound textual engagements because Bible is all over the place in that survival. If you center that in how we not only think about what we do with the Bible, but in fact actually rethink about the Bible not as a self-evident text. It's not, 66 books. Bible, I mean, even in your argument, shows that when we talk about Bible, we're really talking about something else because we're really talking about what all of us do with it and usually don't admit we're doing. Wimbush is saying, what happens if we look at what African-American peoples did and do with Bible? It helps us rethink even what Bible is. And some of the more kind of anarchistic, mystical, non-elitist ways of thinking about what the Bible is, and he would say the textual critique that you're making is right in there. I mean, that's not how people of African descent on this land base engaged the Bible. Reading was forbidden. It was an oral text, small t. And so the framework says, what if we put that history, this history that you so well deconstruct, eradicates that history. The frameworks can't even see it. If you center that history, the sort of notion of Bible completely implodes, and the argument comes up, or the sort of interesting sites become fundamentally different. And I still think, I think you can use reason without valorizing it. I think, I'm not suggesting there's nothing to reason, but I think that it can't do everything. So it can't account for Nat Turner, the enslaved African person who rebelled thinking Christ had called him to do so. And I want to be able to read that as a sacred site. And not, I think it gets erased. And what Nat Turner does, I think Wimbush would call that, he's producing Bible. It's not about what the written text is. There's Bible happening in that moment. And that would completely both implode this history that you also want to implode, but it also doesn't erase, I think, profound biblical engagements that we just don't even see in dominant U.S. elite contexts that happen every week in the black church. And not everywhere. I mean, the black church does a lot of kind of elitist, authoritative texts too, you know, top-down stuff too. But there's other stuff that happens not only in that tradition as well as other non-dominant traditions that I'm worried this framework sort of erases, and also that if they get centered, really makes us think differently about what Bible even is, if it's really taken seriously. So that's kind of, I still kind of want to stand there and say, I can't see any of that history
being able to really be taken seriously in this framework. So, and that just, and so we disagree. It just continues to worry me a little bit.
Yeah.
So, but 99.9%, when you're responding, I'm like, yeah, I agree with that, but I want to do something really different with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Winbush is probably signifying scriptures. Is that what you're...
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I have thought about it. I know him. But I've never really understood the entire concept or its viability, to tell you the truth. And so, yes, I can understand that different people do different things with the Bible, and that has been important, but that is not quite the argument I am making. The argument I'm making is that some of those people believe that the original meaning of the Bible was this, when it is not. And whatever we call anything else they're doing, some of them think they're doing that. So I have a bit more, perhaps, in my book on fighting words and how scriptures function. I call it inscripturation. And yes, you can do many different things with the Bible, not just African Americans, but Hispanics, you know. I was asked once to write something on what does it mean to be a Latino biblical scholar? What, you know, and I say, well, I don't think of myself as a Latino biblical scholar. I think of myself as a biblical scholar who happens to be Latino. You know, it's like there's no Hispanic astronomy or Hispanic chemistry, you know. It's just chemists who happen to be that. So that's how I see the Bible. I'm more of a scientist, you know, than not that I scorn any other sort of approach. Anthropology includes many approaches. But I just don't see how Winbush's view of signifying in Scripture really has helped me understand. As much as I read his stuff, he actually got me on one of his lists somewhere, you know. So that, you know, maybe further conversation, you know, we'll do that. So that's good too, you know. I'm open to seeing that. Well, thank you very much for inviting me again. And
thank you to Drs. Avalos and Harvey. Our next event is 3 weeks from today. It's that point in Monty Python where they say, and now for something completely different and better. We're really fortunate this year to team up to some extent with Above and Beyond Cancer. And 3 weeks from today, some of the members of their most recent expedition to the High Himalaya will be reading creative nonfiction that was written on and after and afterwards. Yasmina Madden in the English department has been working with them on this on her way to a publication of these stories. So please join us in 3 weeks. We won't be here. We'll be in Cole's library reading room. Thank you. Have a good night. Yeah, thanks so much for coming to drink. Oh, thank you. I just wish we could have fed you.
Oh, right.